This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Liam Fox, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. We'll take a look at the big stories from the region over the past week. Coming up, a warning to avoid dodgy and potentially harmful cosmetic dental procedures. Archaeologists unearth insights into 19th century colonial life in French Polynesia, and Fiji's police force has its first turban-wearing Sikh officer. We'll have more on those stories coming up. First, it's been a dark week in Papua New Guinea after violent rioting in Port Moresby spread to other parts of the country. A state of emergency is now in force after at least 15 people were killed and shops and businesses looted, then torched in the capital and in the industrial hub of Lae. The Prime Minister James Marape has suspended the police commissioner and other senior bureaucrats in the wake of the riots, which were sparked by a protest by police and other public servants over a reduction in their pay. Speaking on Friday morning, the ABC's PNG correspondent Tim Swanston says the situation has calmed down, but the impacts will be felt for some time yet.
When I was driving around Port Moresby yesterday, it was just in a state of absolute carnage. You know, for example, one of the major warehouses for one of the largest retailers here, Brian Bell, it was ransacked and burnt to the ground. And, you know, so much packaging and rubbish was strewed for basically hundreds of metres. You know, so, there's a very, very significant rebuild and cleanup effort that needs to start getting underway here in Port Moresby. But the security situation has certainly calmed. So we saw that state of emergency declared from the Prime Minister yesterday night. As part of that, there's about 1,000 defence personnel who are on standby. And I guess that's a recognition that ultimately that although things are calm right now, things are, of course, still fairly volatile and unpredictable.
The repercussions of all this are essentially twofold. The impact on the population of Port Moresby and the impact on the government of James Marape. I mean, first of all, the impact on the wider population. Supply and demand is going to be severely hit by the sound of it.
It's just immense. I mean, of course, for many Papua New Guineans, they generally shop, you know, most days. So not being able to go to the grocery store for the last 2 days or so has certainly been a big hit for the household. And now, you know, we are expecting shops to kind of start opening today. But, you know, the issue will be just simply availability. You know, when so many of the shops have been burnt down and their stock completely destroyed, you know, there's some serious fears for the food supply and stocks that's currently sitting here in Port Moresby right now.
Now, as far as the Prime Minister is concerned, it would seem that there will inevitably be a vote of no confidence call when Parliament resumes, because the grace period, as it were, for Mr. Marape is about to run out and allow that vote to take place. But in the meantime, a number of MPs have already resigned. He suspended the police commissioner and a number of government bureaucrats. I mean, it sounds like the government is not exactly in a state of free fall, but it's certainly crumbling at the edges.
We are, of course, seeing, you know, several MPs resigning from government right now, and exactly on vote of no confidence. There was certainly talk of a possible vote of no confidence, you know, next month. It was kind of widely expected, but now it appears to be all but a certainty. So as far as the government ranks right now, 6 government MPs have exited. Now, these are mostly coalition partner MPs, but that puts the pressure on Prime Minister Marape right now. And of course, the opposition have called for him to resign from the position. But if we have a look at what some of these MPs were saying when they announced their resignations, you know, they're very scathing towards the Prime Minister. Keith Idahu, he's the MP for the Central Province of Hirikoyari. He says that he's shocked and ashamed at the level of chaos and civil unrest that the capital faced because of bureaucratic negligence and confusion. He says, throughout the ordeal, I felt your silence, Mr. Marape's silence and inaction to handle the situation was deplorable.
Now, the government version of all this is that the rioting was sparked by the protest by civil servants and police who were complaining about money being taken out of their pay packets. And we've been told officially that that was the result of a glitch in the system. I mean, do we know any more about that yet? Do we know who was responsible for that glitch, which has turned the country into a state of emergency?
The government narrative is the government introduced legislation about the tax-free threshold, increasing that to about 20,000 kina. And they said that they made that a permanent feature of the budget last year. Now, they say, though, that Department of Finance and Treasury staff basically didn't then update that change for this year in national payroll systems. So when they say glitch, ultimately now they're basically saying human error, that they failed to update the payroll for this year, and therefore public servants who are in that pay range, which is quite a considerable amount of them, were taxed at a much higher rate. And of course, you know, as a result, their pay was severely less than they expected it would be. That then, of course, as we know, led to those demonstrations that we saw on Wednesday morning. You know, police, defence and other security personnel were protesting outside Parliament House demanding to see the Prime Minister. There was, of course, a lot of frustration. The government are basically saying that created the conditions to allow the rioters and you know, looters to basically start. And then by the time that, you know, clearly police were being directed to try and get on top of the situation, that it had gotten out of hand. So the opposition basically described it as a complete lack of command and control. That was put to Police Commissioner David Manning last night, and he effectively agreed with that assessment that they didn't have command and control on Wednesday evening. And now, you know, they are paying the price. It appears that the Commissioner of Police has been suspended. So too have the Secretaries for Finance, Personnel Management and Treasury as well.
PNG correspondent Tim Swanston talking to Richard Hewitt. Economist Paul Barker from PNG's Institute of National Affairs is a longtime Port Moresby resident and something of an unofficial historian of the city. He says this week's riots are a tragedy, especially for the businesses that were targeted, with many considered to be good corporate citizens.
An extremely unfortunate situation because, as many people have observed, the businesses that were raided were taxpaying businesses. The small portion that have been doing the right thing, that have lived through the pandemic, really struggled their way through the pandemic, and then you know, have had no special benefits. Some of them have had problems in the past, like there was sort of a fire for one of those businesses. It struggled to survive. Their business struggled to survive after that. Now, some of those supermarket chains have seen two of their stores burn down and several of their other stores and warehouse raided. So this puts a massive burden on these businesses that, as I say, as well as causing fear and anxiety across the whole community. But certain, as some people have observed, the have-nots have certainly become temporarily haves as they've wheeled out everything from barbecues to shopping baskets filled with goods. And but one question that I have is, where are people going to be getting their food supplies over the next days and weeks? Because all those stores are going to have been cleaned out. And yeah, that's a real challenge.
Absolutely. I'm wondering, though, from your perspective, what, if anything, could be done to lessen the chance of this happening again?
Well, it just demonstrates that sort of social cohesion is a fragile thing. It does very much require the communities to work together, and it requires the police all to be there in place, supported by, where necessary, by defence and other security, as well as the private security guards. So it does require very close cooperation and cohesion. There was no justification in, as I say, there was meant to be no tax increase. So how come people didn't talk to each other? One of the points that people have been raising is, when you have concerns, there are not the automatic mechanisms for raising concerns with government and appeasing situations where so the need to be much better mechanisms for automatic dialogue, and that, you know, you don't lay down, the police don't stop work if they've got concerns, that they are immediately, their unions and their management are in dialogue, and if there are concerns they're resolved properly. And as in this instance, if there should have been no concerns anyway, because there should have been no tax increase imposed, then you know it could have been resolved before it even started. So it demonstrates that all parties, the bureaucracy, we have 1,300 government institutions here, often they don't talk to each other. There's a need for government institutions to coordinate much better and for constant dialogue with the people who are at the bottom of the rung. So that's the rank and file, public servants, including police and so on, and with the community.
Paul Barker speaking to Aggie Tupou there. To other stories, and the Fiji Dental Association is warning of dodgy operators who are putting people's health at risk. They're calling out beauty parlours offering cosmetic dental work at bargain prices. The FDA says they are not licensed and are using cheap and potentially harmful products. Marion Farr reports.
Dr. Parikshath Naidu wants everyone in Fiji to have beautiful, healthy teeth.
I'm the current president of the Fiji Dental Association, and I'm also a private practitioner running my practice here in Nandi. I've been a dentist for the last 20 years.
But he says a growing trend in the country is putting people at risk.
In Fiji, there's a huge market. There's a huge demand to have some sort of tooth jewelry placed in their mouth, from rubies, sapphires, gold, and even diamonds. What started to happen now is a grey area where dentistry crosses over with cosmetic work.
He's pointing the finger at some local beauty salons, which aren't licensed to do dental work.
They were doing dental work, replacing missing teeth, putting cosmetic jewellery on teeth, and operating on dental teeth from their saloons at very cheap price.
Dr. Naidu says the beauty parlours use materials that aren't safe for the mouth.
When they would advertise that this is something that's cosmetic, it's a jewellery, you can have a 22-carat gold fitted in for $5, the procedures was being done in unhygienic conditions, and they were using toxic epoxies within patients' mouth. And when this kind of work failed and it became toxic, the metals they use started to corrode because of the mouth is in a moist environment.
He says the procedures can cause serious complications.
We have heard reports where the gum tissue was burnt, the gum and the lips were stuck together, and when they were peeled off, it created blisters and ulcers, and then the metal was eroding, causing the teeth to start having massive amounts of decay.
Some of the reports are extremely concerning.
We have heard rumours that some of the patients had teeth operated on. The beautician used a filing instrument to chip off a tooth just before they could put a nail art on their teeth.
Dr. Naidu says eventually clients seek help from proper dentists.
When the things went haywire, the people would go down to a dentist with a complaint that this is what happened, I'm so embarrassed with what has happened, can you please fix me up, and that the dentist then has to fix up the problem.
The Fiji Dental Association has issued an alert urging unlicensed operators to stop practicing. Dr. Naidu says the demand for dental cosmetics is on the rise.
Our culture here is very similar to the Afro-Caribbean culture that they have. Yes, the R&B music industry, you see celebrities with grills and gold in their teeth.
Fiji isn't the only place where this kind of look is popular. In Samoa, young people like Adelaide Akaola love to get gold teeth.
I got my golden teeth when I was 16. It was my dad's gift for me on my sweet 16.
She says her golden tooth holds special significance.
It was my dad's golden necklace or bracelet, I'm not sure, but he said it was his gold that he would use for my golden tooth. And I think the reason why he got that is because it's precious to him.
In her family, the trend has been passed down the generations.
Well, my dad has one, my auntie has one, my mom has two. So I've grown up when I was little noticing them already having a golden tooth.
We're not suggesting there are unlicensed practitioners doing these kinds of procedures in Samoa, Ms. Akaola says getting her gold tooth put in was a simple procedure.
So they melt the gold. It doesn't take that long. After they check in with the tooth to see the size and grill it down, then probably like just 20 minutes after it's done. But it doesn't hurt. I was really happy. I was really happy that I got my golden tooth.
Back in Fiji, Dr. Naidu says there's nothing wrong with these procedures so long as they're done safely. But he has one word of advice.
Please, if you want to have something cosmetic placed on, why don't you trust your dental practitioner who's got the proper training, tools and materials to do something very safely.
That's Fiji Dental Association President Dr. Parikshath Naidu ending Marion Farr's report. Archaeologists in French Polynesia have shone light on early colonial life in the country, finding evidence of a pearl industry and that traditional marae were dismantled to build missionary settlements. It's a rare insight into what life was like in the 19th century when French Catholic missionaries were sent to secure France's influence in the region. Here's Mackenzie Smith.
French Polynesia's islands traverse a vast area of around 2,000 square kilometres. And for James Flexner, an associate professor in archaeology at the University of Sydney, it's an area that's long been neglected by archaeologists despite a rich history. Last year, he led an expedition to the Elias Gambia or Mangareva Islands in the country's south. He says the largest island, Mangareva, is a natural site for archaeological work.
When the French Catholic missionaries arrived in the 1830s, they started building, they built churches, they built a cathedral in the main town of Rikitea. They built a royal palace for the family of Maputeoa, who's the first kind of king of the islands during that Catholic period. They built a boys' school and a girls' school on separate islands, all kinds of other features, bread ovens, kitchens, et cetera, et cetera. And it's remarkably well-preserved.
Flexner says French Polynesia's landscapes have escaped relatively unscathed from earthquakes and tropical cyclones compared with its Polynesian counterparts. And in some cases, that's left stone buildings like the ones on Mangareva standing for hundreds of years. For Flexner, the buildings tell a story fraught with early colonial encounters. His team found traditional stone marae structures had been dismantled and the materials used to build churches and other missionary buildings. He says this may have been part of a broader effort to impose Catholicism on the local population.
It's quite common in Catholic missionary practice around the world to build missionary buildings on top of existing sacred structures. So if you go to Cuzco in Peru or Mexico City or Cahokia in North America, they're all, you know, everywhere you go, if there's a big pyramid and the Catholics have arrived, they've probably built a church or a mission house on top of it.
Flexner says the team made their richest finds on the island of Akamaru, yielding over 1,500 objects, including fragments of gin, champagne, and wine bottles. Albert Fahe, director of local cultural association Te Anapounga Mangareva, says the fragments are a significant find.
It means that in Mangareva, during the missionaries' time, we have had and our ancestors, our tupuna, our ancestors have drank this kind of drinks, champagne, wine.
Another important find for the researchers was a collection of pearl shells, which James Flexner says points to the presence of a local pearl industry. By the 1840s, pearl shells, traditionally used in French Polynesia for fishing lures, tattooing needles, pendants and figurines, were being harvested at scale and exported around the world. Flexner says his work in Mangareva has sparked a surge of interest among locals in the history of the islands.
It's given us a kind of regular space to share results with the community, talk about what we're finding, talk about what kinds of projects we can work on together. There's a lot of interest in building a local museum. So thinking of how we can contribute our not only materials, but also just kind of our knowledge and expertise.
He says because French Polynesia follows France's national curriculum, they don't necessarily learn their own history.
What we've done so far has really allowed us to see both the ways that globalization really impacted remote groups of islands like the Mangareva Islands in terms of the range of imported material culture, building techniques and architectural styles, and just ideological changes in terms of the ways that Roman Catholicism transformed people's spiritual lives.
Flexner and his team have two more excavation seasons planned next September and October.
Mackenzie Smith reporting there. And finally, Fiji is known for its cultural diversity, with a significant portion of its population descended from Indian labourers. Among this demographic are a minority of Sikhs. Once distinguished by their turbans, the wearing of them has faded somewhat, but now a farmer's son is proudly donning his to become the first turban-wearing officer in Fiji's police force. Here's our Fiji reporter, Lithe Mavono.
In Vanuatu's Ndriketi, Fiji's second largest island, a young dreamer set his sights on joining the Fiji police force.
My father is a well-known farmer in Vanuatu, and he used to teach me a lesson that if you respect others, respect will be given to you.
For 20-year-old Navjit Sohata, policing was not just a career choice, but a calling that aligned with his values. Yet doubts lingered about his acceptance into the force, particularly as a turban-wearing Sikh.
To become a police officer was my childhood dream. I haven't seen a fully Sikh officer wearing a turban. If I got the opportunity, so I wanted to become a police officer with a turban.
Christians make up 64% of the population in Fiji, while Sikhism, a faith that originated over 500 years ago in India, represents less than 1%. Central to their practice is the act of service, with the turban serving as a symbol of this devotion.
There are five principles we need to follow. So firstly, you need to be respected, you need to be honest, helpful to others, be kind. So I got that and I wanted to save the people.
Navjit's journey to the police force started with a recruitment drive. He passed the initial tests with ease, and then came the moment of truth, discussing his Sikh identity with the academy trainers.
I thought that Fiji police force had respected the culture and the religion. Like for Muslim guys, they don't allow to eat pork like that. And for Indian, they're not allowed to eat beef. So I knew that the Fiji police force will respect the religion. I was just approval by our, say, commissioner. If he approves, I'll be in the force. If he doesn't approve, so I have to choose another career for me. So I just waited, and I'm very thankful that our, say, commissioner had approved for me to wear a turban in a Fiji police crown.
Assistant Commissioner Melissa Teki saw Navjit's request as an opportunity to showcase Fiji's diversity. And with declining community trust in the force, Navjit's journey presented a chance to rebuild bridges within the community.
He did well. And we thought that because that's allowing him to meet our minimum qualification requirement for anybody who wish to be a police officer. And that's entitled him to be part of any organization like a Fiji Police, which has service as its bottom line, must at all time mirror the composition of the community that we serve. The part of building bridges, part of strengthening that bridges, part of restoring trust from the community to us, is for them to look at themselves in the structure of the organization.
For the young boy from Ndriketi, the stand means more than clothing, and it's a message he wants to share with others.
Just like to tell them to just be yourself, be confident enough to hold your belief, and be confident that you will overcome the challenges that you face.
Constable Navjeet Sohata ending that report from Lithe Mavono. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.